When it comes to overpaying for healthcare, what's the best way to stem the tide of rising costs? Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation this week. And just ahead, surprise medical bills. Florida lawmakers on the verge of finding a way to stop so-called balanced billing. That's left some Floridians in huge amounts of debt. But a Jacksonville ER doctor says the legislature is looking for solutions in all the wrong places. You can join our conversation now at 549-2937. Also this morning, a comedy about cancer opens tomorrow at Theater Jacksonville. Plus, Carrie Speckman has all the happenings of the weekend. All that and more ahead today on First Coast Connect. But first this hour, the Florida legislature is on the cusp of passing a throng of healthcare-related measures aimed at cutting the cost of treatment. Among those are two bills, one eliminating so-called surprise billing and another creating a database of common procedure prices. Supporters say it's a way to protect consumers, but some doctors think they leave an important actor out of the equation, insurers. Dr. Stephen Kales is an emergency physician in Jacksonville and the president of the Florida College of Emergency Physicians. He joins me now. Dr. Kales, good morning.
Good morning.
Share your thoughts and questions now at 549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. So I guess to start off, we should really go into what balance billing is and what surprise billing is. Can you kind of tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So balance billing really is only a problem for a small segment of the population because when you look at patients at least coming into an emergency department, not all of them are insured or subject to balance billing. For instance, you know, when you look at typical breakdowns of patients that flow to an emergency room, roughly speaking, 25% of our patients are Medicare patients. They would not be subject to balance billing from us. Another 25% would be Medicaid patients, again, not subject to balance billing. Already in Florida law, if you have insurance but you're an HMO patient, it's prohibited. And then there's about 20% of the patients that come to us that are what we call self-pay or uninsured, and of course they have no insurance to offset the cost of the bill, so there's no balance to bill. But what happens in the setting where you go to see any provider, it doesn't matter really, I guess, if it's in an emergency room or in any other situation,
right?
If that provider is out of network, out of your insurer's network, the insurer has some maximum allowable charges that they've arbitrarily determined are going to be how much they will pay. And then your insurance contract with your insurer says what your responsibilities are, your co-pays, deductibles, and so forth. So what the balance is to bill a patient that's in an out-of-network situation is going to be whatever the insurer hasn't paid. That's the balance.
So it's the difference between what the insurer will cover and what the cost or price of the actual procedure, whether it's an emergency procedure or any other scheduled surgery.
Sure.
It's that difference.
Yes, yes. So if you're an in-network provider, let's say in this situation, then what's happened is the insurance company for you has already negotiated whatever that cost is going to be and what the payment for that is going to be with that in-network provider. So with that, what benefits the provider with that is theoretically the insurers will be directing more patients to their practice, and with that they can take a discounted negotiated rate to offset, you know, what they're losing, because they're going to probably make up for it with these patients that are being directed to them.
Right. So I want to get to a call. We already have a call here. Hold on one second. After this, we'll go into what exactly in-network and out-of-network means, just in case there might be some people that some of our listeners that don't know exactly. But we'll go now to Scott in Central Jacksonville. You're on the line.
Yes, and let me turn down my radio. I'm a little concerned about these issues, and let me explain why I have an issue.
Sure.
The patients, of course, are the ones that are being put in a bind, particularly the ones when, for example, emergency services are provided by an out-of-network provider. It's a complicated issue, and I found many professionals don't really understand the situation. But when when you're an in-network versus an out-of-network provider, the situation is this. This insurance company negotiates a rate. Now, nobody talks about what the negotiated rate is. And if you're not aware, then you should be. It's unbelievable how people who are patients of the and receive care, they really don't understand many times what the reimbursement rate is for our in-network providers. They think it's some unbelievable high number. They see the EOBs that are presented, and they really don't understand. So a provider has a choice. He can either take what the in-network physician offers, or he can choose to go out of network and not, and theoretically, and what's been happening, charge what he would like. Now, I would agree that many times there are pretty egregious charges, but to be honest with you, many times the insurance company feels that the charges, which many doctors and things would feel would be a reasonable amount, they feel like that's not a reasonable amount, and
right,
they're only willing to pay under emergency circumstances 40-50%. So the insurances themselves need to cover a higher percentage than what would be a typical elective in-network versus out-of-network, and the patients are getting stuck with the big bills. And I find it to be the insurances, they have the upper hand in the situation because they are not forced to pay higher emergency rate, then they can just pay the doctor whatever they would like to pay them, and that's it.
Right. Well, thank you for your call, Scott. Is there something to be said here that the possibility of these charges being as a result of poor reimbursement rates? It seems like he was saying that there's sort of a longer call, but it seems like he was saying that there is just an issue here with insurers reimbursing doctors for the work that they do, and that's why these costs get passed on to patients.
Well, actually, he brings up a great point, because the situation for patients is when they have insurance, there's this expectation, you know, that the insurance, that the reason they pay a premium, the reason that they have the product in the first place, the reason the country several years ago moved towards this idea of everybody being insured, was this idea that somehow promoted the ability to cover your costs for healthcare. But in reality, insurance companies in general, you know, their job is to make money for themselves and for their shareholders. When patients buy these plans, they're expecting that when they go to get care, be it in an emergency situation or otherwise, the reason they have insurance is to help them to manage these costs. That's the idea of it. But what's happened is insurers have these narrow networks. They're selling patients flawed products where they may be able to afford their premiums, but they're not able to afford the high deductible plans you may have heard of. That's the big push in the insurance industry, is to move people into plans where they're paying high deductibles. And then, as the caller was mentioning, insurers have this arbitrarily determined maximum allowable charge. That's what they say they would allow a provider to charge. They're not asking us what it costs us to provide care. That's their determined thing. And
right,
then, if you look in your contract, it will say something to the effect of, you are responsible, you know, the insurer will pay 80%, but you think, just to make up numbers, you think if the bill is $1,000, the insurer is going to pay 80%, insurer is going to pay $800, you would be paying $200. But in reality, the insurer is going to pay 80% of whatever they've determined to be a maximum allowable charge. Well, that maximum allowable charge may be something like only $500, which means in that scenario, same numbers, they're only going to pay $400, and you're responsible then for $600 in an out-of-network situation, right? Even if it wasn't out-of-network, same scenario, if the patient has a high deductible plan, which oftentimes these products, the minimum for the individual could be $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, even $7,000 for the individual for their high deductible. And if you have a family, it's usually double that for the entire family for the year. So patients are finding themselves in a situation where there's a charge, The insurer pays whatever they determine is allowable, and then the patient is finding themselves on the hook, not necessarily because the provider has done anything different for this patient who's in network or out of network, but because the insurance product that they have is a flawed product, and they're ending up thinking it's covering them more than it is.
Is there something to be said, though, for the just the price of healthcare? We've got some calls, and we'll go to those calls in just a moment here. But is there something to be said about healthcare costs in general? The costs not just of individual doctors and their services, but of hospitals. We've seen this conversation going on since before session started. A recent study, a June study from Health Affairs, rated Orange Park Medical Center eighth on the list when it comes to the ratio of hospital cost to patient bills. So, I mean, is there an argument here that providers could charge less?
Well, let's separate the two for a minute, because you're lumping providers in with hospitals there. You know, Orange Park, they're part of HCA, which is a for-profit health system. They're national, so they're in many different states. I'm not quite sure how many, but I believe they have something like 200 hospitals or close to that across the country. And they're a for-profit system, and that's a little different than some of the smaller hospitals or hospital systems that are not-for-profit. So let's not lump the providers in with what the hospitals are charging. But there's no doubt that there is examples that you'll find of what seems like egregious charges for different types of things, even with providers. I have a hard time trying to explain to you what the costs are for other providers, because I don't do what they do. I can tell you within emergency medicine, you know, we did a study within Florida to try to take a look at, so that we could even educate ourselves on this subject. And the average charge that emergency physicians, just the physician, sends to a patient is somewhere around $679. Now this is all comers, so it's not just the patient that's come in with a heart attack or a stroke. This is just averaging things out.
Right.
But so you're going to find that when you consider that this is from an emergency standpoint, you're talking about unscheduled care that could be happening at 2 a.m. on something like Christmas morning or some other, you know, holiday weekend, whatever. And you have to have, there are certain costs for having somebody available to take care of anything that shows up at that time. So costs are going to be more than maybe a patient wants to pay, but I think they're actually quite reasonable when you look at what we're doing and you look at those numbers.
All right. We'll go to your calls now. Robert in St. Augustine, you're on the line. What's your question for Dr. Kales?
Well, I'm a physician. I'm a family doc for 25 years. I recently moved to Florida. And my first set of labs were incredibly expensive, so I started going through those bills. And I have found, I'm going to zero in on one thing that providers do here that I think is unethical. I needed a variety of blood tests, most of which would be contained in a panel. So I don't, most viewers or listeners may not know this, but you don't have to always order every individual test separately. You can order them as packages.
Like bundles.
So I had labs ordered that cost a total of $360. They would have all been contained in a comprehensive chemistry panel, which would have cost $40 at the local independent lab. I have never in 25 years seen physicians do this. Everybody knows their panels. Everybody knows they're vastly cheaper. I'm a doctor, so I picked up on that. Most people wouldn't even know that. But I've actually thought about, you know, should I give a call to the paper? Would somebody like to do some investigative journalism? Because that's very odd. And the lab, this was the large medical entity in the area. So the doctors were referring me to their own lab for what were extremely overpriced labs due to the way they were ordered.
Well, Robert,
and I don't know who looks at that.
Right.
Is there an authority? If I object the charges and the insurance company said, you're right, I'd probably get the bill. So who's looking at that?
Well, if you stay on the line, we'll take down your information and we'll follow up with you, one of our reporters here at WJCT will. And thanks a lot for your call.
Sure, thank you.
So is there? Can you kind of unpack a little bit about what Robert was just saying regarding the cost of lab tests as a physician? He said he's just recently moved to Florida and he's never seen something like this before. Can you explain that to our listeners a little bit, to the best that you know how?
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. I don't make money on my labs. I don't profit or benefit in one way or another. There's certainly, when you look at how emergency care is delivered, there's different levels of complexity of care. And certainly, if we order a test, and I'm just going to say a test, not even multiple tests, that changes the level of complexity for a patient that you're seeing as opposed to something else. But having six tests doesn't change that complexity necessarily more. So at least in my field, I can't tell you that it really changes things for me at all. Emergency physicians don't own the labs that we send the labs to. That's usually controlled by the hospital. So I feel like one of the benefits of doing the kind of care I do is that I'm able to just look at a patient and say, what do you need, and take care of them. And it really, we see more uncompensated care, meaning patients that aren't able to pay us, or even with their insurance, they're unable to pay their co-pays and deductibles. We provide more uncompensated care than any other provider group in the entire country. So on the one hand, we know that we're going to be seeing patients that can't pay us. I don't know who they are when I see them and they're laying on the gurney there. So one of the benefits of doing what I do is I can just look at the patient there and say, you know what? What are you here for? And just take care of them. I don't have to worry about those costs because it's not going to, in the end, change how I take care of that patient.
Right. We're talking healthcare costs, balance billing, and transparency here on First Coast Connect. What are your thoughts? Have any questions for our guest, Dr. Stephen Kale, the president of the Florida College of Emergency Physicians? Give us a call at 549-2937 or send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. So sort of getting into what the actual bills that have been that are moving through the legislature right now regarding balance billing. These are measures that lawmakers who are in support of it say will change or will help customers or patients not pay these surprise bills by requiring ER physicians to inform a patient of possible out-of-network costs up front, and sets up a system for insurers and doctors to work out their differences for reimbursement. It's, I think Representative John Wood described it as taking the patient out of the equation. And quickly, we have a lot of calls on the line. Before I go to the calls, though, can you explain to me what you see as the issues with that piece of legislation?
Well, first and foremost, again, benefit of doing what I do is we just take care of the patient and we deal with the compensation and billing after the fact, which is different than many other providers. Like when you go to your doctor's office, oftentimes they're asking you for your insurance up front. How are you going to pay your co-pays and such up front? We don't do that. We're actually legally not allowed to do that because of the Emergency Medical and Active Treatment Labor Act, or EMTALA, Treatment and Active Labor Act, which is a law from back in the 80s. It prohibits us from discriminating a patient on their ability to pay, okay? So what you're really talking about with these bills, there is an effort to take the patient out of it, to hold the patient harmless, so to speak. And the idea being, at least as it's touted, is that if you are not allowed to send them a balance bill, then the patient is going to be held harmless, as you say. But in reality, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about these insurance products with the high deductible plans. People talk about surprise bills. A lot of times the surprise bill is, again, they were surprised that their insurance company isn't covering the cost of their care. They're going to still receive bills, even if these legislative bills that are going to be passed are going to go through, because the insurers have made us their collection agents for the deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance. So even if we are not allowed to balance bill above and beyond a certain amount, the insurance is still going to have their maximum allowable charge. There's still going to be a patient responsibility portion of that. And the patient's still going to receive that bill, and that may be all it is. If you look at the average balance bill in emergency medicine, again, that same study we looked at these things earlier, the average balance bill we send to patients is $372, okay? That's the average balance bill. So That's just for us. It doesn't count the hospitals, the lab charges. Robert was speaking about it and whatnot. But these are small numbers. But a lot of patients still aren't able to pay even that.
Right. Well, I want to go to some of your calls now. Some of you have been waiting a little while here. Bill in Jacksonville Beach, you're on the line, Bill.
Hey, Steve Kales, Bill Horn. I want to say good to talk to you. I love the show. It's been a long time since you and I have talked. I wonder if you could speak about tort reform and the things that emergency providers experience in regards to excessive testing and things like that due to concern over litigation. We see that a lot in a lot of areas where people are either ordering excessively, doing excessive testing because either there is an implied threat or concern over litigation. Every time you turn on the TV, you know, did something happen to you at the hospital? Did you something go wrong? You can sue. You can make money. It's some kind of financial bonanza, and the kind of a pinch it puts us in.
Sorry, Bill. Yes. Can you speak to Bill's point?
Yeah, what he's referring to is what's sometimes called the practice of defensive medicine, meaning, a patient comes in with a problem, let's just say chest pain, and let's say that you don't think it's something serious, but at the same token, you know that if this is the one in the million patient that is presenting atypically and has something serious and you miss it, then your practice and livelihood is threatened because you're going to be sued for what you missed. So
we're talking about malpractice insurance.
That's what he's talking about. That's right. And so what will often happen is you'll have some providers, not all providers do this, but some providers will order some things above and beyond to try to cover or minimize those risks of missing something rare. You know, in this push with healthcare costs and quality, there's a lot of discussion about physicians and providers limiting resources or controlling resources to try to be more cost efficient. Even what Robert was talking about, you know, trying to bundle things together to try to make it a more efficient delivery of care, and it's a great idea in concept. But the problem is again the tort system in this country is such that. You know, I'm not benefited in any way by all the great care. I shouldn't say I'm not benefited in any way. I'm benefited in by giving great care to patients. But when I miss something, I'm heavily penalized for missing that something. Even if the care I gave was perfectly reasonable, and if you took 50 other doctors, they would have done things virtually the same way. If you have that kind of rare presentation or just unusual presentation and there's a bad outcome, providers are often on the hook. So many providers now have gotten to where they're uncomfortable leaving stones unturned, if you will, and that definitely drives up cost of care. But the answer to that driving up cost of care is to say, if you're going to follow guidelines and recommendations, are you going to be protected if you followed things appropriately and done good care?
So we're just about running up out of time, but I do want to ask, what would you or the College of Emergency Physicians put forth as an alternative to this plan, these plans that we're seeing in the legislature right now?
Sure.
They say this is like a first step to addressing the systemic problems with
sure.
healthcare costs. What would you put forth?
Well, you know, one of the things that we've been saying the entire time that this issue has been brought up is we're happy to get the patients out of the middle. And we have no desire to see patients harmed, but what you have to do is you have to have protections for what we call the healthcare safety net, you know, that ability for a patient to show up at any time and receive care. There's a cost to that, and so we have to have some protections of what if patients aren't going to be balance billed, that means the providers are depending on what the insurers are paying them. And if the insurers are being depended on, and 4 out of 5 of the major insurers have been sued for manipulating usual and customary reimbursement data, if that's the situation we're going into, we need a good definition of what usual and customary should be so that everybody's on a level playing field. In New York, there was a lawsuit against a major insurer that ended up in the establishment of a not-for-profit independent entity called Fair Health. Your listeners can look into it, go to fairhealthconsumer.org, and they can find some information, and they can find some healthcare cost transparency. And what we like about that is it's not able to be manipulated by the insurers, it's not able to be manipulated by the providers, and they have percentiles of charges that we could establish as a benchmark. For instance, in some states, it's the 80th percentile of Fair Health is established as a usual and customary benchmark for what an insurer should pay if the provider's out of network, and that provides a fair basis or standing for the negotiation between providers and insurers so that they will be in network, which, by the way, emergency physicians are in network in this state about 88% of the time. So it's a small problem, but if you're the patient it affects, it's a big problem for you.
Right. And quickly, before we wrap up, does this mean that you would support, or the College of Emergency Physicians supports, any type of expanded coverage, expanded Medicaid specifically, or anything like that, that might actually help with some of the balance billing, or is that irrelevant?
Well, I think again, it blurs the lines, because coverage doesn't equal access.
Right.
Just because you have coverage, and ask many people out there who have insurance, that doesn't mean they have access to things, because again, the cost for their patient responsibility side of things sometimes is still cost prohibitive. And the
right.
last thing we want is a patient making a decision on taking care of their health because of the cost, but many patients actually make that decision and they delay care and come to us sicker because of it, and we don't want to see that happening.
Dr. Stephen Kales is an ER doctor in Jacksonville and the president of the Florida College of Emergency Physicians. Dr. Kales, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead on the show. Later in the hour, a play starring some of WJCT's own is tackling terminal cancer with comedy. The cast of Theater Jacksonville's The Melville Boys joins us, and The Spectator, Carrie Speckman herself, gives us the lowdown on what's going on this weekend. But up next, Jacksonville's Veterans Court celebrates a milestone, 4 years treating Jacksonville's service members. Back in a moment with more First Coast Connect.
Healthcare providers want to learn how to spot victims of human trafficking. It's hard, though, because those people are trapped.
Just 100% control. Someone literally owning you, running your life, every single inch of your life.
I'm Kai Rizdal. What it's like to be the human in human trafficking, that's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bankin for Melissa Ross. The Jacksonville Veterans Treatment Court offers alternatives to veterans who find themselves in the criminal justice system, usually because of mental health and substance abuse issues related to their service. According to the Jacksonville Veterans Court, about 150 veterans are arrested each month in the River City. The court held its first docket 4 years ago yesterday. Jacksonville attorney Randy Reap works with the court, and he joins us now to talk about the court's fourth anniversary, the current state of veterans care, and its future. Randy, welcome to First Coast Connect.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
So I guess starting off, 4 years, what do you think has changed in Jacksonville for veterans that are struggling with these issues that come up against the criminal justice system?
You know, it's not just a Jacksonville issue, but a state issue. Basically, it's been 5 years, 5 to 6 years that they've had the opportunity to create a veterans court, different circuits, and we created it 4 years ago. I think if to ask what's changed is the acceptance and the awareness that veterans who find themselves in the crossroads of the criminal justice system suddenly have a different level of advocacy that didn't exist prior.
And you know, how does that really affect individual lives here? Because really it comes down to the individual veterans that go through this program. And I want to get into the specifics of the program because there might be still many in the city that don't know that this is available to them. But how do you see this affect an individual life?
So recognize that I don't even speak for the court. I'm a defense practitioner that petitions to get people into Veterans Court. And I'll tell you, generally speaking, it's as a result of traumatic brain injury, PTSD, or alcoholism or other types of substance abuse, and how it changes it specifically to that last component, the criminal chemical intersection, alcohol or drugs, is it literally changes lives. It is a huge oversight that the court has on an individual. It is not an easy court system to go through. And then you'll see these people generally, and this has been my experience, be extraordinarily successful with the structure that the Fourth Judicial Circuit has put in place. And in the two cases that I'm extraordinarily familiar with, they've gone on to be very productive and, more importantly, very healthy.
Now, you're a veteran yourself, correct?
I am.
And so has this given you think, a different perspective when this court, this idea of this court got off the ground?
You know, and I wasn't involved in the founding or the fundamental part of it, so to be clear on that. But I think what it gives me is a good opportunity to talk to a client who is a veteran or a service member, that can be also a service member, who is struggling with some intersection with the criminal court system, and to explain to them an option that didn't exist previously to put their life back on track. And some would argue to reward them for their service. And I would take exception to that. I would tell you that it is to recognize that it's likely because of their service that they suddenly, otherwise law-abiding citizens, find themselves in a criminal justice context.
Right. And there was more than a healthy skepticism about Veterans Court. And even still today, there's a lot of skepticism with your work in the court and with your work with specific individuals. What is the most effective way to kind of, you know, erode that skepticism, to show people this is something that is needed and that can work?
It's very funny you say that, because, you know, in the city of Jacksonville, when it's not uncommon, peers of mine will be in uniform at lunch and somebody will want to come up and buy their lunch, right? We have adopted healthily the heroism of a military service member. It's when they're charged with a crime that it's sort of like the bus has left the station and that person is no longer known to me, if you will. And so I think education is one, but also the work you're doing, the recognition that veterans often are suffering from unique problems because of the extraordinarily unique position we asked of them to go into voluntarily, as I might point out. So the education to the layperson, more importantly, though, quite candidly, is the judicial system gets it, and they're adopting it enthusiastically.
So in your experience, How exactly, what's the path forward to kind of expand this use, aside from education? I mean, I guess logistically speaking, just practically speaking.
I think the practitioners, the lawyers involved, and I should point out, not just the lawyers, but some of the greatest Americans I know are retired service members who are volunteers or otherwise employees of the judicial system. You know, John Holzbar is the PD representative for Veterans Court in Jacksonville, and you're not going to find a better American. In fact, he's probably taught me more about Veterans Court than I could have learned anywhere else, and it's those type of people who are educating the defense bar, the prosecutors, who sometimes are a little bit less inclined to refer people to Veterans Court, although they're coming along greatly. So basically, it's really my job in the defense bar to know that this option exists and to know how to appropriately petition for entry into Veterans Court.
So kind of going into the specifics of first of all, which people are able to take advantage of these services when they come into the criminal justice system or of this court. What are some of the criteria that these individuals have to meet?
There's a long list of crimes that are excluded from it, and it's the ones you might imagine. Extraordinarily violent crimes are not included in options to get into Veterans Court for a myriad of reasons. There's a bunch of others. But let's talk about what is inclusive. You have to have a charge that you even loosely can tie a nexus to the military service. PTSD has a strong correlation to what has resulted in violence of a domestic violence nature or those types of things. The chemical, I lump those together because of the drug use in veterans and due to the services that they've been exposed to has increased greatly in the last decade. So those type of things like DUIs, those sort of things are eligible. You have to petition for it, but we have to petition demonstrating a nexus between the military service and the problem that we're suggesting is the reason they've been arrested. You can imagine with a DUI, it's sort of easy so long as their alcoholism started as part of the military.
So very quickly here, the Veterans Court basically connects these veterans with services that they might otherwise not have applied for or
No, and very quickly, it is a extraordinarily strong oversight by the judiciary, which means basically they go to court every week for approximately 14 months where Magistrate Sampson, who's the lead guy here in Duval, is going to have oversight of them, making sure that they comply with extraordinarily strict criteria. It is not an easy program.
Right, definitely. Well, where can people learn more about the treatment court? Where can they call?
Well, I you know, my office does a lot of veterans court. I know that 255-HOPE is a reference point if they wanted to call, and certainly the internet has a myriad of services and the veterans court the Fourth Judicial Circuit court website has links to it as well.
Randy Reap is works with the Jacksonville Veterans Treatment Court. Randy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Ryan.
Much more still ahead on the program. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
She's been called a crook and a con artist.
She was not the kind of person I would trust alone with a child.
But lots of people did trust her. And because she calls herself a Christian, no one can shut her down.
The law is unfortunate. It allows these type of daycares to open up without any restriction.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
NPR is investigating a missing persons case in China.
Do you have hope?
Yes, I have hope. That's why I'm here.
A Chinese-American woman looks for her missing little sister. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about lead, why it was used in pipes, paint, and gasoline, how it came to be regulated, and who's being exposed to lead today in addition to the people of Flint. Our guests will be historians Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner, authors of the book Lead Wars, The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's Children. I hope you'll join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross. Theater Jacksonville is bringing playwright Norm Foster's The Melville Boys to life this weekend. The story follows two brothers, one with a terminal illness whose lives change when they meet two sisters while on a relaxing weekend trip. The show stars WJCT's own news director, Jessica Palumbo, and was directed by our own facilities manager, Michelle Simkulit. Hi.
Good morning.
She joins us now with a preview. Good morning. Also joining us are Jordan Bourne and Miles Hughes, who play the Melville Boys. Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Morning.
So, Michelle, you're telling me a show about cancer is actually funny?
Hilarious. Yes, it is. Actually, Norm Foster, who is one of Canada's most prolific playwrights, has written well over 40 plays when he was in his 40s, loves to put ordinary people in extraordinary situations. And that's exactly what this is. And extraordinary situations are always funny, aren't they?
I think so, yeah. They make for extraordinary stories, usually.
Cancer's a funny thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, was there any type of, I guess, preview? Has anyone seen practiced a show at all?
Well, a handful of people, yes, including Patricia Van Stone, who's the executive director of the Foster Festival, mm-hmm. which is Norm Foster's festival in Canada, in Ontario. And she was the original Loretta, who Miles Parra, who's not here today, plays, but it was great to have Loretta, who's also directed the show, come and take a look at it. But tonight is student night, so we're going to have an interesting audience who previews us before we open to the public tomorrow.
All right. So, Miles, I've got to ask one question here. Did you grow that mustache and mullet just for this show? Or
So I had longer hair and not like a full beard, and so I trimmed down to the handlebar. For those of you at home who can't see, I've got this horrendous mullet on top, and I had to go.
Horrendous? I call it powerful. It's a powerful mullet.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you.
It was so sad. The hairdresser's clipping away at my hair, and every time she's like, I'm sorry.
She's crying tears into hair clippings, essentially.
Exactly.
So, Jordan, your character has a year to live. Has that made you think any differently about your own life, or do you just try to kind of push that out of your head?
Yeah, you know, it's so real. Yeah, that's the biggest thing, is it's such a real issue. And, you know, so many people get cancer. And so the fact that I could be playing something that hopefully never happens to me, but if it does, you know, I kind of say, what would my life really be like? And then play that. You know, that's one of the challenges of being an actor, is taking on the entire persona of that character. And having an issue like this is, and trying to find some comedy in there as well, is challenging, but it's so much fun, you know? And hopefully, like I said, it never happens. But yeah, it's definitely real, and it happens to everybody.
Do you think that perhaps, and this is a question for all of you, do you think that being a part of this show sort of gives you the opportunity to see everyday maladies that maybe aren't as bad as cancer or something like that as an opportunity for comedy? It, you know, approach it with comedy.
I think it's really hard to meet anyone who has not been touched by cancer, or to your point, something as serious. And we have all, I think it's our human spirit to bounce back and find the humor, or at least find the love, which with two brothers and two sisters and a hot mess of a weekend, we see a lot of. Even when it is serious, it's based in the fact that I think as humans, we want to be there for one another, and we want to be able to count on one another and know that we can be counted upon. So yeah, I think we see that. We talked a lot about that in the preparation of this show, is the fact that we had to keep reminding ourselves that this is actually a comedy first, because it's real life, and it's real life for a lot of people.
So quickly to wrap up, can you tell me when and where people can go watch the show this weekend?
We're in Theater Jacksonville, which is in the heart of San Marco. The theater's been around since 1919. It's easy to spot. It's called the Little Theater. And tickets start for the opening night tomorrow, and it runs all the way through till March 20th. And that's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday afternoon.
All right, that's Melville Boys opening this weekend at Theater Jacksonville. Find out more at theaterjacks.com. Director Michelle Simkulit and actors Jordan Bourne and Miles Hughes, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And coming up after this break, for more events for your weekend, including the Northeast Florida Veg Fest, you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
Think they are all alone, when they think no one is watching, that's when people reveal their true selves. On the next Snap Judgment from WNYC and NPR, peek behind the curtain. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Herding cats or wild dogs? Which is it? America had to listen to that and choose.
You know, people so are badly actually watching this.
You don't know what's happening.
Gentlemen.
Now imagine if your job was to caption or transcribe those GOP debates in real time. The hardest job in show business. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm
I'm Carol Hills. Next time on The World, what babies learn about language while still in the womb. Turns out if they're exposed to two languages, even before they're born, they can hear the difference.
And they're able to track the rhythmical properties of each. So they're born ready to learn two languages and not confuse them.
How researchers figured that out, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT. Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross. The 6th annual Northeast Florida Veg Fest takes over Riverside Park this Saturday. This event highlights local, sustainable, and eco-friendly organizations and businesses, with a day full of live music, cooking demonstrations, and more. The event is presented by Girls Gone Green. Executive Director Julie Watkins joins us now with a preview and a look at their annual No Meat March campaign. Julie, welcome.
So much veggie goodness going on this month, I tell you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thanks for being on.
We are so looking forward to this event. This is our 6th time that we've put on the Northeast Florida Veg Fest, and it seems to grow every year. This is going to be our biggest one yet. We're talking about a record number of vendors. And, you know, that's kind of hard to find in Jacksonville, those that are local, organic, eco-friendly, humane, but we're going to have a lot of great nonprofits out there too. So it's going to be a fun-filled day for sure.
So how many vendors? How many are we looking at?
So we're looking at about 70 vendors that are going to be filling up that park out there, and then over 10 of them are going to be food vendors. So that's also a record for us because it's hard to find in Jacksonville, veggie options around here. So they're all going to be vegetarian/vegan. It's going to help everyone that's taken the No Meat March pledge this month that's trying to go meat free for 31 days. And they're going to have, it's going to be from Caribbean to Mexican to Indian to comfort vegan food to raw food. I think we've got it covered, Thai food as well. So you are not going to starve out there at this event. And then we're going to have great cooking demos. So you'll learn all these great things that you can make and, you know, start to feel better and get healthier and then just you learn about different foods. That's what it's all about. It's seeing, you know, what are our options out there these days? What company should I support? And help kind of build them up here in Jacksonville. So that's what's great about this festival is we've been able to do that with a lot of companies that come and vend. Now they're setting up some brick and mortar places, and it's really helping to kind of change the landscape of the city.
So aside from the food, which I know for most people is probably the most important thing, and especially for people who aren't used to eating a vegetarian diet, encourage you to try it out and mm-hmm. you'll be surprised the different combinations you can have with vegetables. But in terms of the nonprofits and other organizations that are joining you this time around, what are we looking at there?
Yeah, so great question, because we have a lot of animal rescue groups that come out there and they're sanctuaries. In fact, our beer garden is sponsored by Bold City Brewery, and all the proceeds are going to benefit the Useless Animal Farm in Palatka. And this lady, Odie, who runs the farm, is amazing, and I love her. And she rescues all these, you know, goats to cows to pigs to dogs. She's just filled with all these animals that need a good home. And then we're going to have cats and dogs on hand. And then we've got rabbits that are also rescued too. So there's going to be a lot of animals up for adoption. We do a pie eating contest, which is fun, on the main stage at noon. So you're more than welcome to join in. but we're going to have about 6 contestants, and all you have to do is just show up at the stage and we'll pick you from there. And what's good though, is that everyone asks, where do you get your protein, whenever you tell them that you've cut out meat? And this is going to answer all of your questions for that. You know, where do you get your calcium? What are my non-dairy alternatives? What things can I eat now? Hey, I'm starting to work out. How can I build muscle? And what things, you know, do you recommend that I start incorporating in my diet? So we'll have Vegan Health and Body that will be set up as well that will help you kind of get on track for that. But it is supportive of No Meat March, so people can still sign that pledge. It's not too late. You go to nomeatmarch.com for that, and you can go meat free for 31 days.
Well, she's Julie Watkins, Executive Director of Girls Gone Green. You can find out more at nfvegfest.org and nomeatmarch.com. You can also take the pledge there.
Yeah.
Thanks, sure. Julie, for joining
Thank
me.
Thank you.
And finally, this hour, there's a lot to do around the First Coast this weekend. Here now, Here now, as she is every Thursday, this time by phone, with a look at this weekend's events in the is the Maven of Mirth, the Mistress of Mayhem, the Spectator.com's Carrie Speckman.
Yay!
Hey, Carrie, how are you?
They didn't put clapping in your script, I'm sure.
No.
That's all right. I'm a self-clapper. Okay.
Well, that's great. Well, tell us what are we looking at for this week, starting with...
Well, Ryan, it is going to be a stupendous weekend here in Jacksonville. Starting today, we have the Home and Patio Show, which is a twice-a-year event, and probably everybody who lives here knows about it. They have hundreds of, like, remodeling, home improvement. They have hot tubs and all kinds of cool stuff. And they have some special guests from DIY and HGTV. And Jacksonville Magazine is sponsoring the cooking stage, which means I will be wrangling chefs for the next 4 days. So if you come down and we'll do cooking demos and get some samples. And that's today through Sunday.
All right, great. So what's going on tonight and Friday?
Tonight, Black Violin. I don't know if you're familiar with them. I just learned of them myself. They're a classically trained duo from South Florida. It's Wilner, Will B, Baptiste, and Kev Marcus Sylvester. they are known for blending classical, hip-hop, rock, R&B, and bluegrass, which is pretty cool if you ask me.
Jeez.
They were named one of the top five new bands at South by Southwest, and that is pretty amazing. They will be at the Ritz Theater tonight.
So, can you tell me, there's something very interesting on your list here. It's called the Claws for a Cause Lobster Bake.
Everything on my list is interesting, Ryan.
This is particularly interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
It is a benefit. Memorial Park, they've been doing a lot of things to, like, improve the park and redo the statue and all kinds of cool stuff. And this is, I think it's their second annual. It's called the Claws for a Cause Lobster Bake. It's at Cool Moose Coffee Company. And in case you are a vegetarian or vegan, your lobster bake will actually be an eggplant parmesan bake. Or you could also get barbecue chicken. But they'll have cocktail hour and dinner and just good time supporting Memorial Park.
All right. Well, thank you, Carrie, as always, for bringing us
Well, let me mention one more thing real quick. Oh, the Riverside Arts Market is on Saturday at 10 a.m.
Right, of
this
course.
This is like the big opening for the year. Just wanted to throw that in there.
Well, thank you so much. And you can find out more and listen to Carrie's podcast, Another Round, on her website, thespectator.com. Thanks again, Carrie.
Thanks, Ryan.
And that's our program. Thanks to all our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed any portion of today's show, subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also watch clips from the show at our partner TVJax.com. I'm Ryan Bank. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our Media Roundtable Week in Review. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.